Hello, welcome to Start Your Week with The Bunker. Listeners with kids, prepare to enjoy your last week of homeschooling for now. Perhaps you can let them bring in games and wear their own clothes on Friday and make a special day of it. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me to take us through the next 7 days is Arthur Snell, former diplomat, ex-head of the UK Prevent Programme and International Man of Mystery. Hello, Arthur. You are joining us from your mobile studio, aka your car, aren't you?
That's right. Just trying to mix things up a bit.
Why are you in your car on top of a hill?
Well, it relates to animals and living in the countryside, and I had to pop out, and I didn't manage to pop back in time. So I thought I'd just park up on a foggy hillside.
And the COVID police say, what are you doing here, sir? Well, I'm actually podcasting, officer. Of course you are. Of course you are.
Yes, exactly. A likely story.
A likely story, sir. Please come with me. Anyway, right, this week, obviously, the budget is this week's big event. Rishi Sunak's under pressure to find an extra £43 billion to plug a hole in the UK's finances after the pandemic. We've been told rises in corporation tax are coming. Meanwhile, the Treasury Committee is saying it's not time to put up taxes, and a group of Red Wall Tories are calling for a cut in business rates to protect small businesses. What is going to happen, do you think, Arthur? I mean, predicting what's going to be in a budget is always a bit of a fool's errand, but how do you think it's going to play out this week?
Well, I guess the big question, which has been sort of on everyone's lips for a few weeks, is does Rishi Sunak try to kind of make back the money now, the huge sums that Britain has spent on the pandemic, or does he go pretty soft, keep the money flowing to the businesses and sort of try to make it up later? The challenge that he's got is that at the last election, the Tories promised that there were going to be no tax rises to income tax, national insurance and VAT. So it doesn't leave him much room for manoeuvre. Of course, he could argue, well, these are a unique crisis circumstances and all bets are off, but I don't think he's going to do that. So he's basically got a few levers he can pull in terms of kind of stealth taxes, slightly obscure ones that people don't notice when he's giving the speech and they only figure it out a couple of days later. And then the other big one is corporation tax. And it does look likely that there'll be some kind of announcement to bump up the corporation tax. The challenge with that, of course, is that corporation tax rises are felt by the owners of small businesses. And of the small business owner is perhaps your archetypal Tory voter. So whilst someone who set up a hedge fund registered in the Cayman Islands, such as Rishi Sunak, is not going to be affected by corporation tax rises, the sort of person who runs a small or medium business, maybe in the south of England, which is your kind of Tory heartland voter, will be affected. So it's a tricky tightrope that he's trying to balance.
There has been talk about further taxes on wealth as well, capital gains tax, inheritance tax. These are kind of taboos for the Conservative Party, which is makes routine commitments not to raise taxes as part of its election platform. There is talk, though, that wealthier older people will have to start to pay some of this this bill for the pandemic. And obviously, we can debate what the nature of that bill is. But Ken Clark last week was raising the idea that older people who continue to work after state pension age should pay national insurance like all the rest of us do. Do you think that some of those Tory taboos are going to get tested?
I think they're going to get stretched, but maybe not fully tested on this occasion. I think that there's been a sort of rear guard lobbying action, particularly by that new breed of so-called red wall Tory MPs, where in general, you know, their voters are not as well off as your sort of classic Tory voter down in the southeast. The basic difficulty is twofold. One is that the Tory party now represents two rather different sort of slices of the electorate. So the sort of the long-term middle class, as mentioned in the southeast, who possibly, you know, might be able to afford to pay a bit more tax, perhaps wealthy pensioners, people like that. But then you've also got the new so-called red wall Tories. These are the more kind of culture-based Tory voters, Brexit supporters up in the north of England. And they are really not well suited, particularly in the light of the pandemic, to weather a heavier burden of the tax. Or they certainly don't feel they are. And I don't think they've been sort of sold that as a possibility by their political masters. So you know, Sunak has got undoubtedly a very tough choice ahead of him. And he's still, we should note, he's still promising to keep funding small businesses, particularly the sort of high street, the restaurants and the other things that have basically are just being kept on life support at the moment. He's promising to keep that life support going. So the huge sums of money going out of the door are still going to go out of the door for a few months to come.
How do you think it's going to shake out politically for him? Because the Sunshine Sunak outshining the Prime Minister thing, you know, munificent and beneficence and launching furloughs and so forth, has, I mean, his political profile, Sunak, has absolutely rocketed since this time last year. And it's never a good idea for a Chancellor to outshine a Prime Minister. How do you think that is likely to shake out?
That's a very interesting question, because I think part of the Sunshine Sunak is in a weird way, it's against his own instinct. So I made a slightly snarky reference to Sunak's Cayman Islands hedge fund, but it's not incorrect to say that he's someone whose ideological instincts are in big global sort of corporate finance, very mobile money markets, and he's somebody who is not naturally comfortable at all with a kind of big spending central government propping up businesses. But the pandemic has upended all of the kind of norms of political calculation. So I think he's developed a brand, and I think he must be acutely aware that he is one of the very few really popular Tory politicians at the moment. And I don't think he's going to let that go. I think politically, this budget will feel like a relatively good times budget. And there'll be various sort of words about, we can't carry on doing this forever, but we probably are going to carry on doing it for a little while. And I think that's where, so it's sort of sunshine, but it's towards the end of the day. We can see the sun setting. I feel that's sort of where it's going to be.
There does seem to be a weird kind of fight brewing between old school spending phobics in the Tory party and the new Tory big spenders like Boris Johnson. You know, the government is now dominated by the kind of people that would have given Margaret Thatcher conniptions, spending not just to deal with the pandemic, but the levelling up agenda, which pre-exists the pandemic, is anathema to those old school Tories, isn't it?
Absolutely. And isn't it weird? Because Margaret Thatcher is the divinity which they all worship. But both on their approach to the EU leaving the single market and their approach to public spending, they're a very long way from Margaret Thatcher's own ideology. And I think one thing is undoubtedly the case is that the success of the vaccination programme means that there's a reasonable probability that the British economy will start to really take off later this year. So whilst it would be easy to say, well, all this public spending is kind of economically illiterate, they don't want to take the hard choices, there is a good chance that the British economy is going to be humming along, not because of any economic brilliance on the part of the government, but simply because you've had all this pent-up demand. People haven't been able to do all kinds of things, whether it's go on holiday or go to shops or go to cinemas or all kinds of other stuff. And actually, one is very cautious to say this, it does seem as though by sort of June, July, actually life will be pretty much normal again. And so that is going to have a huge impact economically.
Keir Starmer's going to have to react to this on the fly, as all opposition leaders always do. He's said it's too early for tax increases of any kind. Do you think that the budget could be the restart button that Starmer's been looking for?
I'm not sure that it would be. I don't think that it is Starmer's sort of natural, it's his best game is reacting on the fly in a kind of witty yet slightly cutting way that will give us sound bites to hear for the rest of the week and all the rest of it. I'm sure he's going to be listening intently for the stealth tax rise that he can then draw attention to and try to put across to the British people that, you know, there isn't something for nothing, that the Tories have pushed up corporation tax, thereby hitting the small business owner, or they've pushed up capital gains tax or some other, you know, stealth tax rise, which obviously we don't yet know the shape of. I think in real terms, you know, Starmer's well aware of the fact that the big message of the budget, which I think is going to come across as being, yes, we need to put up taxes, but most of that's going to happen later. And for the moment, we're going to continue to support businesses. He can't disagree with that. So unless he's got a very strong message about something very different that Labour would do, I think it's quite a tough message for him to deliver.
Elsewhere on coronavirus, we're just hearing about serious concern over a case of the P1 Brazilian variant of COVID-19. 6 cases in Britain have been identified, 3 on flights to Aberdeen from Brazil via Paris and London, and one of them is currently untraceable. This is pandemic movie type stuff. Labour has described it as down to a lack of a comprehensive border system. So do we expect this one to dominate the week ahead?
I think it might do. It's hard to know how much sort of room there is on the news agenda with the budget happening. But yes, I think it does, because it does seem to point to this weakness in the government's approach of saying, well, we're going to have quarantine, but there's going to be huge gaping holes in the quarantine system that any person could very easily figure out if they want to come to this country from, for example, Brazil. And ultimately, if you look at countries that has successfully managed a really, really strict border regime and got their cases down to minimal levels, I'm talking about countries such as Australia and New Zealand, but actually closer to home, here in the British Isles, the Isle of Man has also managed that. The way they've done it is by saying you can't come in or out from anywhere unless you've had very strict tests and you go through a really, really strict quarantine, a quarantine which means that all the workers in the hotels themselves are being tested. And, you know, it feels a lot more serious than the one that's being implemented here.
Mm. Vaccine passports to allow people to travel or to attend large events look like they're going to become more contentious this week. More than 200,000 people have signed a petition against them, saying they could be used to restrict the rights of people who've refused a vaccine. And that means this is an official Parliament petition, so Parliament may have to debate it. Is there more to this than just, you know, generic COVID scepticism and anti-vaxxing and that kind of thing?
It's a difficult one, because on the one hand, I can feel the sort of civil liberties question here, which is that, you know, there will be some people who, for, you know, fairly good reasons, may not have gone for a vaccine, and others who may not have gone for a vaccine for very bad reasons. But it becomes one of these barriers to entry, which, you know, separates out different parts of the population. And I think in almost any other circumstance, I would have a little bit of sympathy. But I just feel, given the seriousness of this whole pandemic, the devastating impact it's had on every aspect of ordinary life, it does seem to me that it's picking a really rather unnecessary fight. And I just feel that I just wish people would choose a different battle.
It's immensely complex, though, isn't it? Because Nick Cohen, friend of the show and semi-regular, was writing over the weekend about how this will, you know, vaccine acceptance or lack thereof will fall, as these things always do, on, you know, deprived communities. And we've got vaccine hesitancy amongst BAME communities and poorer people. This is surely, you know, de facto going to create, you know, the people who are less likely to have the vaccine passports are going to be from excluded communities. So it's not just about personal liberty. It's about erecting further barriers to people who are already excluded from society.
I think that's a fair point. But I think that the remedy for that is for the government to work a lot harder. And, you know, to be fair to them, they've done a bit, but they need to work a lot harder in the outreach to those communities. And you know, the education and communication aspects of it, so that you do reverse those kind of low take-up rates that appear to exist in particular underserved communities. It seems to me that if you can't find a way to effectively facilitate the activities of the vast majority of the population that has taken the vaccine, then actually the upside of having a really successful vaccine program is itself dented. So you've got to sort of juggle those two requirements.
Meanwhile, it is the last week of homeschooling, as I mentioned earlier. Kids go back on Monday. Gin sales will rocket on Monday. Testing pupils is a huge part of this, though, and secondary school pupils are going to be expected to get home tests twice a week. This is going to be easy, isn't it? Teenagers are famously cooperative and consistent in their approach to these things.
Ah, yeah. Now, you're talking to the father of a teenage daughter, and also, as I think I've mentioned in the past, you know, my wife, as it happens, works in public health. I think there's quite a lot of concern in the public health community about this. These are tests which you administer by shoving something a long way up the nostril of a grumpy teenager, and they're tests that are not particularly effective, quite often show a false negative. So I think, you know, any realistic assessment of what a harassed parent who has no medical training and is expected to administer this really quite sort of uncomfortable test on their child, we're going to have a huge number of dodgy results. And I'm sure there'll be some parents, not many, I'm sure, but there'll be some probably who just don't administer the test but send in the results anyway because it's all too difficult. It's better to do some testing than to do no testing. I accept that. But I think that this is a very problematic rollout that we're about to witness.
And there's no priority vaccination for teachers in the new second phase of vaccination. The Guardian has quoted one teacher as saying there's an impending sense of doom about the return. How do you expect this one to play out this week as we get closer to kids going back?
Yeah, it. I do feel worried about this because young people who are asymptomatic, spreading the illness between them and then passing it back to the adults that they live with or interact with in their home lives, you know, that is undoubtedly one of the ways in which this illness has continued to spread throughout the population. The urge to get kids back into school, of course, is one of the key elements, you know, the challenges of homeschooling, the stress, the fact that loads of people can't homeschool properly. You know, they may not have access to reliable internet or IT or all, you know, there are so many barriers. There's so many problems with homeschooling. But the fact that we have not decided to vaccinate teachers, and again, the arguments there, you can understand, you know, the vaccination council, which is full of extremely eminent scientists, you can understand the arguments that they've made. But ultimately, you do have this problem now that you've got a huge part of the population that is now mixing freely. You know, I know schools will do their best to maintain some level of social distancing, but in real life, that isn't going to happen. So I think that we are going to see, you know, a lot more of the virus being allowed to circulate. The only upside is that you do now have a significant proportion of the vulnerable population are now vaccinated. So hopefully that will just reduce the impact of it.
Just a few things to cover before we wrap up. Obviously, we're always very careful about this, but the political situation in Scotland has become a bit of a spectator sport. The surgeon, Stamen Vendetta, is amazing, and Stamen's claiming his former deputy ran a deliberate, prolonged, malicious and concerted effort to trash his reputation, even to the extent of having me imprisoned. So, Arthur, without English splaining, because we cannot claim any expertise here, although it is astonishing to look at. Have you been following this? Is it like... Can we say anything about what we think might happen on this one?
Yeah, well, I've been trying to follow it. And at one level, it looks like a relatively simple story of a very powerful political movement having a huge kind of power struggle carry on inside that movement, which is, you know, Salmon versus Sturgeon. The complexities of it, the allegations, because, of course, this does not relate to the court case on which Alex Salmond was cleared of all charges of allegations against him, but it does relate to a subsequent inquiry on similar issues, albeit a separate inquiry. It looks very complicated. I think, you know, there's a risk of people south of the border, particularly those who regard themselves as unionists, of slightly rubbing their hands and saying, oh, well, this gets us off the hook. The SNP is going to screw itself up, and therefore we don't need to worry about Scottish independence for another year or so. It's not clear to me that that's the case. Yes, this is a very unedifying spectacle, but that doesn't seem to change the strong likelihood that in the Holyrood elections, the SNP will do very well and probably win a majority. And we're still faced with the same problem from the outset, which is that this is a very powerful movement that seeks independence for Scotland. And nobody who is on the other side of the argument has yet apparently come up with a sort of successful, counter-argument to persuade the Scottish people that that they don't want to back the SNP.
Well, I've actual Scots who actually know what they're talking about in some depth on the show soon. We promise that. So
that sounds like a really good idea, and I don't need to feel so uncomfortable.
A couple of things on the Arthur Snell foreign desk here. The killings in Myanmar are worsening. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah, so obviously there was the military coup in Myanmar, and then a very widespread and very kind of impressive wave of protests, which appeared to have real kind of energy to it. If I'm honest, and I don't want to sound at all kind of ghoulish about this, I was sort of surprised that the crackdown hadn't already happened. The military junta in Myanmar has a very clear track record of being willing to be extremely draconian when they want to. And I felt slightly that we were just sort of counting down the days until they said, right, we've had enough now. We're going to spill some blood, and that will change the calculus. Well, tragically, that appears to have happened, and there have been killings of protesters in one or two different cities. Now, what we don't know is what impact this will have. Will these heroic protesters for democracy continue their struggle, or will they be sort of cowed? I don't know yet. It is something that we are watching unfold before our eyes. But the other development, which is important, is that the elected, effectively sort of prime minister, Aung San Suu Kyi, who obviously comes from the democratic movement, albeit there have been controversies around her stance on the rights of ethnic minorities in Myanmar, but she is due to appear in court today on charges which ludicrous as they sound. She's charged with illegally owning walkie-talkies, but that was what the military junta got her for when they arrested her at the start of the coup.
Blimey. And just finally, the emergence of the Khashoggi report. What did it conclude? How will that play out? What do we need to know on that one?
Yeah, so this is obviously the Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, who was lured into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was murdered, dismembered, and ultimately fed into an incinerator, a totally disgraceful and awful story. At the time, various intelligence agencies, notably Turkey and the CIA, had quite a lot of information about what had actually happened, including, it is alleged, an audio of the entire ghastly event unfolding. Out of that, a US intelligence report was prepared, and this was a classified report, and this is obviously during the Trump presidency, which sort of explained what had happened and attributed responsibility to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, widely known as MBS. This report was classified under the Trump administration because, of course, Trump got on very well with MBS, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was also very close with MBS, and there are suggestions that there may even have been some kind of sort of economic relationship there. Trump, at the time of the murder, very kind of, disingenuously speculated that there could be any number of things that have happened, albeit, if you're in the Saudi consulate and you're murdered, that presumably is the fault of the Saudi state. So the report was hushed up, but the incoming Biden administration had made an undertaking to declassify this report. And they delivered on that. They waited until President Biden has had his first phone call with the King of Saudi Arabia, King Salman, who is, of course, the father of MBS. And so the report emerged just at the end of last week. It's there on the internet for anyone who wants to read it. It's not a particularly informative report. It's only a few pages long, but it lays out the central point, which you could argue is pretty obvious from the start, which is that if for this to have happened, Mohammed bin Salman, who controls almost everything that happens in Saudi Arabia, had to be on board with the outcome. So it basically, it sort of lays to rest any idea that somehow he was not responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Now, this will increase pressure on the US government to introduce more sanctions on Saudi Arabia and possibly even sanctions on MBS himself. I think the Americans will want to try to resist that. and sort of try to put this behind them, for all the considerable distaste that you can imagine that exists in response to this awful killing, as has been the case for many years, Western countries need to be able to work with Saudi Arabia for a range of reasons in the Middle East, including the ongoing struggle with Iran, including trying to bring an end to the civil war in Yemen. And so I think the Americans are going to be trying to say, well, we've laid out clearly what we believe happened, and we regard that is, you know, that is now the end of the matter. But I think those who are campaigning to see justice for Khashoggi and on the sort of wider issues of Saudi Arabia's activities in Yemen, this will just be yet another sort of piece of evidence which will be used to pursue that case.
Arthur Snell, thank you for joining us from a lay-by where you're waiting to meet your contact from Carla and or whatever. your secret dead drop. Arthur, thanks for getting up so early and finding a hot spot on a hill to talk to us. Listeners, thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with the panel show and a major guest, Alan Rusbridger, former editor of The Guardian, will be here to talk about his new book, News and How to Use It, and whether we can drag ourselves into a post-post-truth era. And also, on top of that, we've got exciting news for our Patreon backers, but you'll have to listen to find out what it is. So subscribe on your favourite app and you won't miss it. Arthur, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.